Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have back as my guest Paul von Voord, who is the author of several books. We interviewed Paul in the past on God's Genes and Consciousness, and he's back with his new book, We've Never Been Alone, A History of Extraterrestrial Intervention, which goes into much greater depth of the concept of our what I believe to be our true history. It certainly has a lot of meaning to me in terms of the different areas that he covers in this book, especially explaining the current archaeological evidence, the current evidence of how full-blown cultures came to pass within 5,000 years with mathematics, astronomy, science, medicine, and other things. And that would be, so the evidence would be that we have had help from advanced beings throughout the entire known history of human history and probably before. Welcome, Paul. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
So, I guess we'll start out a little bit with your interest in the subject and how you came to delve so deeply into this theory of advanced beings influencing human history.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of touch points over my long life, but I think I could really go back to my very early years growing up in fundamentalist Christian culture. You know, we grew up reading the Hebrew texts, the Roman texts, all that are pulled together in the Bibles that people read today, many different versions of Bibles, and that's one of the issues here. We can talk about that at another point. But, you know, it seemed to me when I was very young, in my teens, reading the accounts of the ancient leaders of the Hebrew tribes and the Exodus and so on, and the discussions of interactions between the humans and the gods. Because before I started reading the Bible, I heard the minister talk about God, you know, the God. Mm-hmm. And then I started to reading it for myself, and there were all these different gods. And I began to wonder whether this is just fiction or, as I learned the word later on, allegories or metaphors, or is this some sort of maybe partial, fragmented, because the texts in the books that we have doesn't flow in a logical timeline and so on. You jump from one thing to the other. So I think that started it, you know, and I went on in college taking cross-cultural courses in religion and philosophy and so on, and you began to see other religious traditions talking about gods as well, and I began to think about these things myself as sort of a question. And I have to say that the first book I remember reading that really set me off was Eric von Daniken's book, The Chariots of the Gods, because
right.
He sort of really focused on that. And so I started over the years while I was doing other things in my traditional military, diplomatic, non-profit international person mucking around in cross-cultural things with the Soviet Union and China and that sort of thing. strange enough, all along the way, I was reading these books about other interpretations of the history that we have in our religious traditions. And I guess it was about 15, 20 years ago that I began to say, well, if this notion that these historic texts are really parts of the historical memories of early humans, there ought to be some other evidence out there. And, of course, I looked, as all of us, I think, who are interested in this have done, looked at the architecture, the archaeology, and those kinds of things. But I said, you know, that makes us the case, but maybe those were early humans, you know, that created that and so on. And I thought, well, what are the other areas? And, of course, one of the first things over the last 10 years or so has been research in DNA. And we have now have geneticists who project into the past with certain assumptions on their part. And they have come to points in history where they say these things probably happened on in such a period, like moving from Homo erectus to Homo sapiens, like Homo sapiens moving into Homo sapiens sapiens. And those shifts from one species to another are those are big gaps and leaps in evolution that can't be explained by the normal natural selection process that we see in plants and other animals, and even in the earlier history of hominoids and other humanoids, the Homo erectus types of beings. So that was one area that I dug into, yeah. And we described that in the book. Then looking at the dispersion of racial types and languages, mm-hmm. all of these areas then began to me, in any way, from my own perspective, corroborate these ancient texts as historical text. And anyhow, that's a long answer to your question. But you know, you start seeing the pieces, and if you sort of look at things from a particular perspective, saying this, our study of the human story should not just be anthropology or genetics or the fossil hunters doing their thing. We have to put all of these pieces together. So I sort of invented this concept of interdisciplinary cosmology to say, okay, we have to look at all of it, including our own inner ways of knowing. And this brings us right on up to the present time when we have so many reports from people who communicate with other beings through interdimensional channels. And then we have the abductees and contactees who make a strong case for physical interaction with these advanced beings. And so when you begin to put all these pieces together, you see a totally different story of who we are. We've never been alone. There have been interventions and interactions in human history, physical history, psychological history, cultural history, and as you mentioned early on, the knowledge, and what's interesting is that all of the cultural legends, the oldest memories that humans have, they include this notion that more advanced beings coming down out of the sky taught us things about astronomy and architecture and the body, the science of the body, the medical techniques and practices, you know, thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of years ago.
And even language.
And even languages, yes. In fact, all of them talk about their language. I'm talking about the major languages. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Hindu using the Sanskrit alphabet, which was allegedly given to the people of South Asia by a god named Saraswati. Mm-hmm. This female goddess gave them the alphabet. And that's I don't want to get sidetracked here, but Sanskrit is really the oldest syllabic letter-based language, which has this characteristic of reflecting every sound that a human can make. And of course, we humans are the only ones with the Fox P2 gene that lets our sound-making apparatus function as subtly as it does. But all of the Sanskrit letters go from this bottom of our register right up to the top. When we do the om, you know, you start in the bottom of your throat and come right out the lips as you work the sound the way up. This is a that's a scientific language. It is a language of, based on physics. And, you know, so to say this just sort of happened is rather fanciful in my view.
Well, last week we interviewed Michael Cremo, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one of the things in there that caught my attention, I wanted to mention to you, if you hadn't seen it, was the evidence that there was a silver inlaid vase found, I think, about 200 million years ago in, you know, in a rock formation, kind of literally blown out of the rock formation. So obviously something like that, if it really came from that geological age, had to be put there by extraterrestrials. There's no other way that it would have gotten there.
Yeah, well, I, you know, Michael has done such good work in dating and identifying so many areas that there's no other explanation.
There is no other explanation. I mean, either you don't accept the premise that, you know, if something is embedded inside a geological rock, it couldn't have gotten there any other way, which, you know, it logically it couldn't have. But basically, with his work and with the work of scientists, including my cousin, who is Doug Wallace, a geneticist that traced the mitochondrial DNA back to the original Eve, which is mentioned in your book. It seems that, you know, humans, human-like creatures were present for millions of years on the planet, but then something happened about, what would you say, 150,000 to 200,000 years ago that caused something genetically happened at that point, an intervention most likely by advanced beings, who took the humanoid type beings and then somehow genetically changed them, some people saying adding their own DNA. And that's where we started with Adam, Eve, and the Garden of Eden and all of the really the known history in our religious textbook starts from that point.
That's right. And one of the things that interests me, and I don't know how we can prove it, but it would seem to me that the earliest tales we have that have come down to the present day through the Aboriginal stories, it seems to me that around 250 to 300,000 years ago, when we saw the morphing of Homo erectus into Homo sapiens, and that these early tales talk about the beings coming down, and so they're very simple, whether they're African or Australian or early American. These are the more Aboriginal, what I would call not influenced by the civilizations that, you know, we had springing up around the planet after the cataclysm of about 11,500 years ago. And so it seems to me that those early memories have actually come down to us in our own DNA of our whatever energetic patterns accompany our DNA in the epigenetics that we're now playing with. So that gives us a sense of the early, what happened early on, that some other beings came and intervened. And I would say in that first category, it was probably something and I'd love to have your cousin's view on this, but that first break from Homo erectus to the Homo sapiens was likely to be an in vitro process, you know, sort of mixing some genes that had a significant impact. But then by the time we got to Homo sapiens sapiens, about 200,000 years ago, it appears at that time, and the text suggests this, that then you had actual sexual reproduction of hybrids that produced us as modern humans. And it just, because going back to Genesis, even although that's a fragmented timeline, there was that first creation of the human, the Adamu, and then you had the later stage where there were several women, men that were the forebears, so called, of Homo sapiens sapiens. So you can, I think you can see in the text, and I think you can get it from the DNA extrapolations into the past that we're talking about, and the fossil record, all and the languages all fit in. I mean, the proto-language, linguists suggest that there was a world proto-language about 100,000 years ago. Well, that's when we're talking about, you know, Homo sapiens sapiens arising. And that would involve this exchange point between the gods like Sarawati or Thoth, or depending on which culture you're talking about, describing that handing down to humans these more complex languages.
And the Bible, you know, describes this as the sons of gods looked upon the daughters of men and found them fair. You know, and other religious texts have also said that there was this interbreeding between the humans and the gods. So I think we can assume that it occurred, and then that led to, after the gods were, you know, packing up and leaving, the demigods, who were the result of that offspring, were then placed in the positions of power. You do a nice job in the book of describing that they probably lived in the buildings that the gods had lived in.
Had created,
created, and then sort of took on their energy, but actually didn't know how to use everything in the house, probably.
Right.
Because a lot of it was higher technology. And there were some areas, as you say, in the spaceports where humans or even demigods were not allowed. Only the gods were allowed in the critical areas, which makes sense.
You know, it would make sense. I mean, I try to use our sort of modern society in a way to understand that, because we are, let's take the industrialized nations where we've got the mechanized military, we've got all the intelligence technology, all of this equipment and so forth, and we move into a place like Afghanistan or some other country, and you
we're
have
not
exactly
let the locals into the silo where the nuclear weapons are.
That's exactly right. That's exactly. In other words, you see this same relationship, and what interested
security.
Me. you don't have the security pass to get through.
Right.
Well, I think I think you're right with this demigods. They were probably the first echelon of rulers over the various tribes or the nation states or the god states, whatever term we want to use, because you had Yahweh here and you had Baal there and you had some other god here, and each had their own set of humans who, by the way, served as foot soldiers a lot of times in the wars between these gods, a habit which we have not overcome even 3,500 years later.
And why would we if we are of their DNA?
Well, that's it, it's the It's the DNA, which does account for a lot of our emotionality, our inability to separate, you know, our rational thinking from conditioned habits and belief systems.
Right.
I mean, I think that's that's one way to think about it.
And you do go over the evidence that there were nuclear wars back then, probably between the different advanced beings that were fighting for control, mainly of the spaceports, it looks like. It looks like a lot of the
I think that's right. Certainly in the middle
warfare, just like we would have now. I mean, it's you don't fight over nothing. You fight over things that are important.
Well, continuing this little metaphor here, you know, so we have the Persians today, the Persians of old who are in Iran today, who are trying to build their own Tower of Babel to compete with the more advanced cultures in the West and around them. And it led to the wars that you know you the more powerful ones were going to stamp out the weaker ones, and you could see this in the Indus River Valley because it's not only in the Dead Sea area where I think there's a considerable amount of evidence in the Sinai Peninsula of a nuclear war of some kind. But it's also the case in the Indus River Valley. And it's interesting that that has been dated back to only 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. So now I think maybe the war where you get this out of the Vedas and the Mahabharata and other texts that talk about these wars between the gods and their impact on humans. But that probably destroyed the areas that we think of as the beginning of India, and it just got wiped off the map, except for the artifacts that are still there, pretty well covered over and broken up and so on. But those are two areas where we have pretty good evidence that this kind of a warfare actually occurred.
And it may not have been too long after some of that activity that that the advanced beings left. You know, because one of the things that, you know, Yahweh was kind of an invisible god, but nonetheless, you know, the when Moses went up to the top of Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments, Christianity has him being spoken to by the magic or the burning bush. But I think the Quran translates that as a plume of a spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have actually gotten those tablets from a spacecraft.
I think that's where we had
himself,
the.
But,
That's where I think that we should look at the history of the Torah and the Hebrew text, because those texts were redacted several times, you know, before the modern era. And they, each time they were – I have a colleague, Roger Voss, who's done some good work on this, going back to the oldest versions that we have – and comparing, and we see how this notion of Yahweh as the God of the universe evolved. And so when that was being changed, I think you had the same editing of what was happening on the mount. You know, it was changed from some other word to a word that signifies the burning bush. Which is
more supernatural. You talk about
right.
that in your book, that, you know, we went from just being a subservient class to a more advanced beings to, once they left, the priest class came, and then the priest class gradually transformed things through changing things and through changing ideas to the fact that there's a supernatural God that we have to pray to through the priest class in order to get things done.
No, exactly. That's the way that, that you talked about. The first set of rulers were the sort of demigods, and then
right.
you had sort of a third level when it was really the more or less all of us are hybrids in this theoretical framework, but certainly the more human, more removed from the advanced being gods who had departed. And they then were the ones that had to try to maintain power.
Right.
And it was a wonderful psychological conditioning program to sort of change this notion that these ABs were not real beings that slept with our sisters and so on.
Right.
But it was some supernatural divine realm that nobody who's a human can understand or touch unless it's a priest who gets the message from on high. And this mm-hmm. was a, I think it was a gradual process, but I think it was a deliberate process.
To keep
control.
And I think that, you know, you pointed out that the United States is one of the most guilty of this thinking, especially when we go to, you know, to take over other countries. You know, we rally around the idea that God is somehow favoring us.
Right. This idea that we are the chosen nation. Yeah.
We are the chosen nation. Yeah. Yeah. So that, and then Yahweh was one of the, I think it's important for the listeners to understand, Yahweh was only one of many advanced beings who had these city-states all over the globe, and different religions and cultures and everything came out of those city-states because they were different. I mean,
they were different. But you see, I think there was a little different approach in the course of Western civilization. It seems mm-hmm. to me that the Chinese escaped that supernatural model, at least as an anthropomorphic supernatural model, because they had, according to the research that I've done over the last several years, and we just had in the last 2 or 3 years recent discoveries in China of more evidence of these advanced beings working with the Chinese part of the globe after the cataclysm. So what was mm-hmm. happening in Sumeria, Egypt, and India, what we call the cradle of Western civilization, and this is how we got this supernatural tradition in the West that we were describing, but in the Chinese plateau, they stayed pretty clear that the ABs were beings. You know, they were real interplanetary or whatever words. They didn't use those words, but that they were real beings, and it didn't get morphed into the separation that we have in the West between the divine realm and the earthly realm, because you have Lao Tzu and his teachings about 500 BC, along with Buddha's, you know, about the same time. And they weren't changing these ABs into what we did in the Western world. We went from that, I call it a period of the AB cults from about 1500 BC or maybe 1000 BC up to about 500 AD, about 1500 years. This is when you had all of the fighting among these groups saying, well, no, our God is the real one and he's the strongest one. And the other group was, claiming that their God was the real one and we'll show you because we'll smite you and destroy you.
Right.
That was the way we proved that we had the real God is, using military.
My God's stronger than your God.
Right. So anyhow, I think we are today still suffering the implications of that kind of mentality. And what I keep trying to argue is that if we would just stop arguing about who's got the right religion and the right belief system, if we could somehow step out of that and say, let's look at how we got these beliefs.
Right, yeah.
You know, how did these ideas develop in the first place? Yeah, what are they based on? It's interesting, right. Elaine Pagels, who is pretty much in mainstream theology and so on, but in her, I think the most recent book on the Gnostic Gospels, not the first one, but her effort to look at the evolution of the supernatural God that we're now worshiping in the traditional mainstream religions. And she is beginning now to also, from that mainstream academic tradition, point out how this supernaturalism was created. You know, from decade to decade, in order to really establish Roman Christianity, because there were these other Christian movements after the time of Jesus, and it was in the 4th century before Roman Christianity, that version really began to dominate all these others. So if we'd sit down as, you know, normal humans talking to each other about this history, and looking at these texts, I think we could begin to solve problems that we're not going to solve as long as we all believe in our own respective theologies that, you know, we've got the answer. We've got we're the chosen ones. I mean,
right.
the Muslims are doing it, and the Christians are doing it, and all the different groups in Christianity and different groups in Judaism and so on. Everybody breaks off into a little. So we're really now within our religions, I think, going through the same period of the cult era that I mentioned earlier back for that 1500 years. You know, we're doing that within our own religions now, and we're seeing it, of course, in the political process in this country as well, where religion is becoming more and more the hallmark of different political groups.
Right.
So it's a kind of
scary.
It is. Well, because it is the effort to impose a theocratic model of government again after we had a revolution in this country to get rid of the theocracies that we were accustomed to having in Europe.
Yeah.
And so here we are 200 years later, really regressing by trying
this is
to...
Not, yeah, this is a time of extremes. You know, we have the extremes of almost every idea resurfacing, hopefully for the last time. I mean, we're hopeful that we can, as we go into this age of reason that is before us, we're hoping that these will just die down and go away. But, you know, they may not. I mean,
they might not, yeah.
Yeah. Unless certain people reach a certain level of consciousness, the idea that I'm special and that, you know, my God can beat up your God is going to surface. I mean, if I just pray hard enough, I'll win this war, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well,
actually,
this
who
is,
wins wars are the people with the highest technology. I mean, if you look at the history of war, it has always been the people with the best technology that win the war, or in some very you know, secluded cases, like the Greeks getting their ships getting sunk. Sometimes there are some you know, things, weather-related things that cause somebody to lose a war. But in general, it's the highest technology, which is exactly why the advanced beings were so feared and their high technology was what gave them the position of power when they were on Earth.
Yeah, and I'm spending a good bit of time now thinking about, I'm going to speak at two or three conferences later this year that try to bring this ancient intervention theory and look at it in terms of current experiences, whether you mm-hmm. want to call them, I still use the term ABs, whether they are ETs or aliens or mystical beings, interdimensional beings. I think we're not in a situation where we were 5,000 years ago or 3,500 years ago, but we still have a lot of interaction on a small scale. When I say small, I mean dealing with individuals or small groups or as many people believe that some contacts and contracts exist between ABs and our technology programs, particularly in the American government and maybe some of the other more advanced governments, but certainly in the United States. And so
that's why we have better technology, and that's why we win wars.
Because
of that AB technology. I mean, there's no question that if you believe the reports of hundreds, if not more, people involved in that program that Stephen Greer has collected, there's little doubt that we are technologically superior because of our interaction with advanced beings. Even though the official government position is to deny that advanced beings exist.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, that there's power in that too, you know.
Yeah.
You want to hide the real connection.
And I think that what we need to do, a lot of Steve and others in the book that Phil Corso wrote some years ago, which was a good case study of what happened in the DARPA program as a mm-hmm. channel for some of this technology to be distributed into the private industrial sector in this country. These kinds of things are going on, and I think as long as we just directly fight that cover-up and lack of disclosure and so on, we're never going to win the ball game. And it seems to me that we need to have more of the discussions like you and I are having here about the bigger picture of how these different players fit into our long evolutionary civilization and see what the products are today, and then try to undermine our pull the rug out from under the notion of these supernatural religions. And we seem to be going in the opposite direction, that the energy behind those belief systems seems to be rising and becoming more predatory in its mm-hmm. expression through all of these groups and in the political process. So that's why I'm trying to talk about this book and others and talk to conferences to try to say we've got to look at this bigger picture, and only when we're willing as individuals and as communities of people to say, hey, we have been we've had the wool pulled over our eyes and we want to clear our eyes first, then we can get together as citizens in a society.
Right. We will no longer be representing the city states formed, you know, eons ago by the advanced beings and fighting against other similar city-states
right.
with other advanced beings, so to speak.
That's well said, yeah, because that way we've got to see ourselves as a human society.
Right, right.
Not as a political division.
The foot soldiers of different advanced beings that may or may not be seen, or
right,
some of whom
right.
have left long ago, and we just keep them alive in the supernatural.
Right.
Because that's really what we're doing. That's true. Now, I wanted to mention a little bit that we mentioned the cataclysm. For mm-hmm. our listeners who don't know about what that was, would you like to fill them in on that? Because they probably do know about the Great Flood.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we now know in terms of, you know, credible scientific data collected by many, many scientists from all parts of the planet is that what we read in our culture as the flood and the story of Noah and that sort of local event. I mean, it was when we read that story, we think about it. You know, it happened somewhere in the Middle East, and maybe the ark is on Mount Arafat, and so on. As a matter of fact, it might be, but it was not just a local flood. There are many reports, and one book I referred to, which is now about, I think, 10 years old or so, written by Allen and Delair, two authors from the UK, who researched biology, geology, astronomy, the legends that were available in all parts of the earth, anything that had to do with a cataclysmic event, you know, there are tales of the sun being completely blotted out on earth for quite a period of time, volcanic activity, tsunamis, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And these events have been dated as we now date things by looking at the rocks using the radioactive time scales to see how long these artifacts have been in the ground, and you know using all of these tools. These two guys looked at studies like that, and they looked for a common time period. And the common time period for so many, and they had about 500 studies that were used to write their book, they all fell in a period between, you know, 10 or 12,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And what that suggests is that there was a global cataclysm that had all kinds of physical effects, not just flooding, but all these other things. And
mm-hmm.
so they picked then sort of the average date, which was 11,500 years ago. Well, now the interesting thing about that date is that's when the most recent ice age was considered to be terminating.
Mm-hmm.
The earth got warmer. Things were shifted around. That also happens to coincide with our oldest discoveries of civilization. One is the Göbekli Tepe site in Turkey, which is the oldest one now that mainstream scientists will accept. And they're finding these structures 10, 11,000 years old. So all of this together suggests that we had this cataclysm about 11,500 years ago that left only a few humans. I mean, when I say few, I'm talking about a few million, or some people suggest that the human race at that period in time was even in the hundreds of thousands of people. So these were the survivors of this cataclysm, and the story of the ark and Noah and his family surviving, you had small groups of humans surviving this cataclysm. And whatever had happened before that, whether it was Atlantis or Lemuria or some other advanced civilization, and I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Michael's work, Michael Cremo's work that you're talking about, and others do show suggestive evidence of advanced civilizations from that period of about 150,000 years ago right up to about 10 or 12,000 years ago. But in terms of the modern history of humans and our culture, we can date it back to that period. And that's when we still had these advanced beings who were giving us technical assistance and helping our survivors to reestablish civilization and to get themselves going again. There were some survivors who were the aboriginals, and they got going on their own outside of these AB assisted areas. But that's another story. You know, the hobbits in Southeast Asia, the Denisovians in Siberia, and other.
But who knows? They may have gotten information from a higher level too, through, you know, through their own intuitive means to.
That's right. That, no,
take
I think
off
that's
and
right.
Do certain things to exactly you know, to prepare rather because it seems like, at least from what I've read, that just about everybody who survived that probably had some sort of assistance from some higher level, be it advanced beings or other other forms of information. You know, interdimensional communication.
Right. Yeah. They would have had to. I think I mentioned in the book the Snohomish tribe in the northwest United States. We don't think about them as being part of that, you know, Aboriginal culture line, but they have their own native traditions. That something like you're suggesting happened. That they got the message. It's not clear.
Or whatever.
Yeah, through their sources, you better get ready. You better
get
ready.
That's right. Yeah.
And they survived in the mountainous area, and of course they're still alive today.
And there is around a 12,000 year cycle as well that we seem to be coming to again. So it's an interesting idea that we are probably going to face some cataclysmic changes in the near future.
Yeah, I'm sort of conflicted about that, whether, you know, seeing the changes that are happening, wondering whether this is part of a natural cycle or whether we have, you know, exacerbated it with our own climate change activities of just human industry, human consumption, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me we probably have maybe a combination there, and that which is frightening, because if we have these natural cycles of upheaval, and then we're adding to it with our behaviors, we may be in for an even more cataclysmic period. I mean, that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. This year should be interesting. And the beginning, about the first 3 months of next year, from what we can see.
That's right. Yeah, we just have to, we do whatever we can, and we go through the tunnel, as it were, and or through the rapids, if you want to use a kayaking metaphor here, and see what happens on the other side. But I would hope that whatever happens is that we begin to really look at this story that we're talking about here. And I have one little bit of interesting an interesting development in the sense I've just been accepted to give a paper at a conference later this summer. There's a group of more or less mainstream academic folks who have reached the point in their thinking where they've said we need to expand the way we look at our history. We need to have it. We need to have it interdisciplinary, and we need to bring in, you know, not just the mainstream disciplines, but we need to look at the religious, the cultural, the psychological. In other words, all of these intangible factors, and try to then begin talking about human history in a much more expansive way, not only in terms of our physical universe, using what we're doing in physics today and our understanding of the multidimensional nature of our universe and perhaps a multiverse and all of those aspects that are a part of that physical expansion of our horizon. But then they're saying at the same time we need to expand our intellectual horizon to encompass some of these other views and even my view in my case. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens at that conference, because the program committee accepted, you know, my basic theme here that we've been talking about as one of the presentations. And so maybe, you know, there's going to be, if we have a even more turbulent period over the next year or so, maybe more and more people will be awakened, you know, to examine some of the concepts and evidence that people like me and others are trying to get the public to give serious attention to them.
Yeah, I think, you know, although people in the mainstream tend to make fun or shy away from conspiracy theory ideas, I think if you look at history, history has always been written by the people who won, and history has always been rewritten by the people who have agendas. Mm-hmm. And if you are just going to go on written history and you don't know those things, you may accept something that is gospel that isn't, you know, that is actually rewritten so that certain people can stay in power.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
You know, I think more than anything, we need to ask ourselves, why is there evidence of a planet X in our solar system that NASA is denying? I mean, these are very important questions. I mean,
yeah,
they really are. You can see this all over the globe. I mean, you go on YouTube and there'll be pictures of it. There's a large amount known about this body, and this body seems to be connected with these cataclysmal things that have occurred intermittently on Earth historically. And so why don't our scientists know about this? My brother's an atmospheric scientist who testifies before Congress, and we had a cute little discussion the other day. I was trying to tell him that if you know, he hears about a tsunami over in Europe, he needs to vacate his Cape Cod house and move inland within 8 hours. And he was saying, you know, well, he'd read something about that. And he said, we continued the conversation, and I mentioned Planet X. And he said, well, NASA says Planet X doesn't exist.
Right.
And I said, well, NASA says a lot of things that are interesting, but, you know.
That's right.
But like there was nothing on the moon when we first landed there. I also told him that, and he works for NASA, and he said, well, that couldn't be true because he would have known about it anyway.
Right, sure.
But the scientists, and my brother's one of them. I mean, I come from a family of scientists. We mentioned my cousin, who's
the premier
expert in mitochondrial genetics. You know, basically, if the scientists of the world don't know what's happening, because it's been hidden, because of political agendas.
Yeah.
We're in trouble.
We really are.
I hate
to
say it, we're in trouble. And God bless you for going to educate some of the historians, and hopefully they'll educate the scientists, and we can get, you know, we can figure out what we need to do quickly.
Yeah, we're so fragmented in our areas of specialty. And I think we take everybody else's word for it because we don't know how to study that material.
Right.
And
well,
so
we're coming up to the end of the hour. Would you give your contact information, Paul?
Sure. My website is just www.vonward, V like in Victor, onward.com. And the book is We've Never Been Alone. And the website has a lot of articles and, you know, connections with other folks who are doing similar work. And happy
and
to communicate.
I just want to put my two cents in. You know, I interview a lot of authors, one a week for over 15 years. This is one of the
thank
most
you
important
for doing
books
that
to read, period, that I've done. Okay? This is critical right now for you to understand based on what's happening in the next year and a half. So, you know, I think that's my little two cents there.
Well,
so, Paul, thanks
it.
So much for joining us, and I hope to have you back on and before the end of the year. We only touched on the topics in the book. You know, there's way more in the book than what we talked about. So,
well, thank you so much.
Thanks again for joining us. Next week, we have Robert Foreman, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, and then Leigh Fortson on the 31st, Embrace, Release, and Heal, an empowering guide to treating cancer. And then on the 7th of April, we're going to have a discussion about the nature of positive interdimensional communication, which Paul mentioned earlier. And then on the 14th, Dr. Fadime will be discussing his book, The Episode of Life, Consciousness, Creation, and the Universe. Thank you very much for joining us, and please check out I Can Do It Retreat at icandoit.net to find out dates for a city near you. Dr. Wayne Dyer, Greg Braden, Louise Hay, Carolyn Mace are some of the speakers. This will be in Atlanta, San Jose, Vancouver, and Toronto. Again, thank you all for joining us, and join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.